Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, happy to welcome to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine for the first time on the show, Dr. Ralph Hamer. And we're going to be talking today about common eye problems in pets. We haven't talked about this in quite a long time, and it's a topic that really is quite interesting. You and I will experience probably some loss of vision, at least a little bit, over our lives. And well, what happens when that happens to our pets? And how is that diagnosed and treated? We're going to talk about that when we come back on Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT after this news from NPR.
Great Wall.
Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm so happy to welcome to the program today, for the first time, from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Ralph Hamer. And we're going to be talking today about common eye problems in pets. Now, everyone here can probably imagine how eye problems would affect our pets. It seems like it'd be a kind of life-limiting thing. However, one thing that I have kind of come to expect from pets is amazing resilience and ability to kind of cope with things that you and I might find especially vexing. So first, Dr. Hamer, let me welcome you to the show. And I'm just going to begin by kind of asking, in terms of perception of the world around them, do pets really use vision in the way that people do, in terms of like vision primarily for us is our primary means of interacting with our world? And pets, of course, and animals in particular, well, they'll need to see for sure. But am I right in my saying that it's not necessarily a life-limiting thing for a pet to have a vision problem?
No, you're right. And first, thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here. And you're exactly right. Different animals will reuse their vision for different things, and it's more or less important depending on the animal. And you're exactly correct. For us, vision is a very important sense. And there are people who have lost their vision, and we can see how they can adapt. But most animals are really amazing at what they can do and how they adapt to not only having one eye, where they're essentially pretty darn normal, and how they adapt to not having any vision at all. Their other senses can really come and help them, and they deal with it far better than I think I would.
How common are vision problems in our pets?
You know, I think they're very common. I think if you look at veterinary medicine in general, one of the most common complaints that is listed are skin problems, and eyes follow quite closely after that. People are pretty attached to their animals' eyes and their expression and what they look like, so they're sort of attuned to that part of them. And so they're pretty aware of a problem and adept at bringing them in, and they're fairly common. Obviously, I'm biased. I spend my whole day long looking at eye problems, but they're fairly common.
So common is a kind of a little bit nebulous to me. When over the course of any given pet's life, might it likely experience some vision trouble?
They're all going to at some level. As we all get older, and I'm certainly experiencing this myself, our lenses become more dense. Our lens continues to grow throughout life, and the periphery of the lens is where the lens fibers are formed, and they kind of squash the center more densely, and it's why I had to get bifocals and now trifocals as I've gotten older. I was told that it really doesn't bother their vision too much, but it bothers my vision, and I imagine it bothers their vision in the same way. So every dog, as it ages, will likely lose a little depth perception, lose a little sharpness of focus, and so they can experience some of the very similar things that we do.
Of course, you or I do a variety of complex tasks. Certainly, you do very complex tasks if you're working on animals and their eyes, but even a task like driving a car – really requires a great deal of the use of vision, right? I mean, you described trifocals, and you can imagine how in an automobile you might need to be able to see something near, like your dashboard or the right. control panel. Right. You might need to see something a little bit further out, like the hood of your car or the street right in front of you. But you may also need to see further down the road. Your eyes are doing a great deal of the work for you, mm-hmm. and that sense is crucial to your ability to kind of interact with the world, whereas a dog that may be a little bit older and experience some vision loss, if he's just kind of doing the normal things pets do and he's not, you know, catching frisbees or rescuing people or something like that, he may be able to get by around the house just because he can see a little bit, and that does him well enough. Yeah.
No, they do great, and they should do great. And most people will just think, hey, the eyes are a little cloudy, that's sort of normal, my dog is doing fine. So most people don't really discriminate that there's a big change, but the potential is there. Depending on what the dog's task is, they're going to be more discriminating about that, and the owner is going to be. So if I have a very highly trained dog that does very visually involved things, I'm a agility dog, I'm a fly ball dog, I'm a high-level obedience trial dog, I'm a hunting dog, small changes in their eye can be devastating to them if it's in the wrong place. Whereas for the average owner, they're not going to really know, and their dog just is great.
This might be a good place to begin with a description of the structure of the eye and really an explanation of how the eye works. The eye is, as far as I'm concerned, a miracle thing. It is we all have them. We all know kind of what they look like, and our pets can have very beautiful eyes. And these structures are doing remarkably complex things in a remarkably kind of compact area.
Right. Right. The pieces are relatively the same for all the species that we deal with and are similar to ours. There are some species differences that become important as we talk about particular diseases. But so we're talking about the eyeball itself. Most animals will have a cornea. That's the clear part of your eye where you'd put your contact on. And that's a part of the eye that has a lot of main job is to help focus light onto the back of the eye. Behind that's a little bit of fluid. Then you have the colored part of your eye, which is your iris, and that's the part that changes shape, and your pupil will dilate and constrict. Right behind there is the lens, which job is also to help focus to the back of the eye. In between the lens and the back of the eye is something that's called vitreous. It's kind of like a jello consistency. And then on the back of the eye is your retina. All of that works to take an impulse, a light impulse, focus it carefully and exactly onto your retina, exactly where it needs to be. Those impulses travel down your retina, are collected by your optic nerve, transfer down your optic nerve, and end up actually in the back of your head at your visual cortex or your visual processing center, and that's how they process the stimuli that comes in.
All of these different components, from the cornea to the retina to the optic nerve, each of these components along the way could potentially be the source of a problem that will affect vision.
Definitely. And they will all have different clinical signs. And they can be easier or more difficult to discern the problem. Things that we can actually see as we look at the eyes ourselves, and we have microscopes and particular headsets, just like when you go to the eye doctor, we use the same kind of equipment. Ours is a bit more portable, but we have the same kind of equipment. Eyeball things we can generally see. As you get into the optic nerve, we can only see the end of it, and then it travels behind your eye in your head. And that takes advanced imaging to look at that. So we can do CAT scans and MRIs and things like that to try to discern that. But yeah, they're all a little bit different in the clinical sign, and that can help us focus in on where we need to search for the problem.
Any veterinary exam probably includes a veterinarian kind of shining a little light or something mm-hmm. into the animal's
yes.
eyes. When that's happening, what is the veterinarian looking for?
The main thing they're looking for is the cornea clear? Is the white part of the eye white? Does the pupil work? Is it constricting? Does the lens seem relatively clear? Depending on your veterinarian's desire, they may be able to dilate the pupil and get a pretty good look at the back of the eye. Some veterinarians are rather comfortable at looking at the eyes in the back of the eye. Some are less comfortable, just like your doctor may have an area where they specialize in more than another doctor. And so they're mainly looking, is it clear? Is it bright? A lot of them can measure the tear test. Are they making enough tears? We can put a stain on the eye to check for a corneal ulcer, which is an abrasion of your cornea, or a scratch. They can measure the pressures of the eye. Are they high? Are they low? So depending on your veterinarian, they can do a lot or middle ground or little. Quite often we'll work with them in tandem to see what they see and then work together to figure out what the problem is.
We have eyes that require lubrication, right? And mm-hmm. and this stands out to me because you did just say there's like a tear test. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't even thought about this because I don't generally think of maybe tear ducts as being a part of the eye, but they're essential to the function of the eye.
Yeah, the tear glands certainly are. Your cornea, while your lens individually is the strongest refractive power. It bends the light the most. Your lens actually sits in fluid inside the eye, so it takes a little bit of that away. So your cornea is actually the most important refractive structure. And my analogy for that is when you go underwater and you're swimming and there's water touching your cornea, you can't see very well. But if you put on a mask or a goggle, it puts air in between you and the water, and that's why you can see again. So air is that air-cornea interface is extremely important to refract or bend the light where you want it to be. And that tear film needs to be smooth. And so dogs have decreased tearing. It's a very common problem, and certainly in particular breeds where they don't make enough tears and they have significant clinical signs after that. So similar to people, but they can't tell us when they are a little bit dry. So we can do that to try to stimulate their tears, get their tear film better, improve the health of their cornea and their vision.
Among eye problems, would malfunction of the tear gland present some of the more uncomfortable symptoms to the animal?
Potentially. I think the more uncomfortable problems happen inside the eye. So if we have inflammation in the eye, or we have high pressure, which is glaucoma, and inflammation is uveitis. Itis is inflammation. Uvea is the inside of your eye. So those things are more painful. Dry eye tends to be uncomfortable on the level, if I'm going to say. But I tell people, you know, if you want to know what your dog is experiencing, try to hold your eyes open for 30 seconds. It's essentially impossible because it's uncomfortable. You just sort of say, I can't stand it. I have to blink my eyes. So it's uncomfortable for them, and they tolerate it more than we do.
So among the range of eye problems that we can talk about today, we can go anywhere from something that is degenerative. Would maybe glaucoma fall under that category? Mm-hmm. To something that's not even related to the dog's own health, and that could be something like injury.
Sure.
So maybe a good place to start is with something a little bit simpler to understand, and let's talk about injury.
Okay.
Right? The animals, like dogs, often get to go out and about and do fun things. What kind of injuries do you see animals present at the veterinary clinic that affect the eye?
So those kind of sort of injury things, I thought the most common thing would probably be a corneal ulcer. And so again, the cornea is the clear part of your eye. The cornea has clear skin on it, which is epithelium. And an ulcer is when that skin or epithelium is gone. And a lot of those common scratches or ulcers to the eye, your veterinarian will see it. They can look at it. They can put some dye on the eye, and it identifies that area. And they can treat a simple scratch pretty well. If those ulcers become larger, deeper, infected, then that can cause more serious problems that need more aggressive and intensive medical therapy, and even potentially surgical therapy from there.
And things like a physical injury to the eye, is that common?
I think so, because that's what we get a lot of phone calls about from regular veterinarians. So that's the part that's exposed, and depending a little bit on your dog. If you have a Doberman Pinscher, they have a very long nose. If you have a dog that's called brachycephalic, meaning they have a short skull, like a pug or a shih tzu, sometimes the first thing that meets the world is their cornea. And they have a very prominent eye and a very round eye that doesn't blink as well. And they don't have the same corneal sensation that a regular shaped head dog does. So I have a big eye. I have a prominent eye. It doesn't feel the same. And it's the first thing that touches the world. So they're very much more prone to a corneal injury compared to a dog like a Doberman Pinscher or a German Shepherd.
Would we as pet owners likely be aware if our pet has experienced something like an ulcer or a physical injury?
Yeah, you should. And my general rule when I tell people is all the eye knows how to do is get red, cloudy, and painful. And it does it for lots of different reasons. The hard part is trying to figure out why is that reason. So pain is I'm holding the eye shut. There's excessive tearing. It's uncomfortable. And it may be cloudy. The cornea, which should be crystal clear, will be cloudy or red. Or brown. The white part of the eye of your dog should look like yours and mine. And if it's red or irritated, I may have something on the surface, some conjunctival disease. I may have something inside the eye. And so as you call and say, hey, my dog's eye is red, my first question is going to be, where is it red? Because where the red is more meaningful to me than it's just red. But it's hard to know because there's a very wide variety of problems that are associated with three simple clinical signs of red, cloudy, painful.
Hmm. Okay, so here's where we might want to help differentiate between something that constitutes an emergency mm-hmm. and something that we want to look out for, but we can schedule an appointment.
Right. And the most common answer to that is if you think your dog has an acute painful problem, somebody needs to see it. And it's difficult to discern. Often we may get a phone call and the owner may say, hey, I'm 3 hours away. And we can say, well, let's at least get to your veterinarian. Can your doctor stain the eye? Can they measure the eye pressures? Then we can maybe say, you know what? It sounds like a simple ulcer. The eye pressures are okay. Let's treat this. And you can come if you need to. Or we say, well, this sounds serious. We have high pressures or very low pressures, or the ulcer seems deep, or it's all the way through the eye. And so we have to work together. But the general part is the more painful your dog is and the more acute the injury is, the more red, the more cloudy, we're going to say, gosh, I think you need to come.
Tell me a little bit more about pressure in the eye. This can be a source of great discomfort or pain. What is considered sort of neutral?
Neutral. Sort of there's a measurement, millimeters of mercury. It's kind of the same thing. You measure pressure and then other things in the weather and all those kind of things, barometric pressure, et cetera, et cetera. But it's 15 to 25 millimeters of mercury is normal. 15 is on the low end, 25 is on the high end. That's relatively similar to people. It's relatively similar across species.
And is excuse me for interrupting, but is it that irrespective of the actual size of the eye structure?
It is. Most of them are the same. Now, there are very particular exotic breeds that will have low. Hawks are different than owls and are different than, you know, gerbils. But relatively, for the average dog, cat, horse, 15 to 25 is a good number. And it doesn't really matter if it's a smaller eye and a puppy or a larger, more prominent eye like a Shih Tzu. Older dogs have a little bit lower pressure compared to younger dogs. But in general, that's a good number across dog, horse, cat, our regular species.
The pressure, tell me about the function that is performing, right? It's a certain range, and within a certain range is acceptable, but what happens if that pressure is changing?
Sure. The fluid in the eye, which is what we're measuring with intraocular pressure, is that fluid is very important to the health of the eye. It's made inside the eye and it flows through the pupil. It's made right behind the iris, flows through the pupil and drains out the drainage angle. And it's important to provide nutrients to the inside of the eye. All of those nutrients, everything that happens, keeping your lens clear, keeping your cornea clear, all that happens from the inside and a little bit from the outside. So we've got to get that at the appropriate amount. If it's too low, if we have inflammation and the high pressure is too low, then it changes that and the eye doesn't function properly, can actually lose vision from that. If it's too high, that pressure actually causes damage to your optic nerve and retina, and you can lose vision from that. And it can be quite painful to go from there. So the intraocular pressure is in a very important number for us to have as we assess, geez, what could be wrong. And the eye pressure helps us a lot with that.
Something that could potentially be considered an injury or at least cause a great deal of discomfort that you might not even be aware has happened because this happens to you or me on probably a regular basis. We feel like we get a little something in our eye.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hesitant to call it like an injury per se. It could just be a speck of dust or what have you. But this probably happens to our pets too.
Sure, it does.
And unlike you or me, our pets don't have the ability to sort of use their hands to kind of like open up the eye and sort of try and, you know, move your eye around and take care of the problem.
Right. And that's sort of the difference of being a veterinarian and being a medical doctor. We can't say, look up, look down, look left, look right. Tell me exactly where you're painful. We have to manipulate that a little bit. They can't really tell us. Sometimes we can try to help discern, is it painful in the front, by giving them a local anesthetic, and then their eye opens up and that tells us it's painful in the front. If it's painful inside the eye, you give them an anesthetic eye drop and they're still painful. So we have to use clues ourselves. We have to communicate very intensely with the owner. The owners know their dog or cat better than anybody, and we have to work with them to say, okay, help us figure this out. Where are they going? So the pain thing can be a little bit difficult to figure out, and we have to do a broad exam and look everywhere because they can't tell us it's up here.
But a symptom that might be visual to you or me would be what? The animal is squinting?
Sure. Yep. So again, holding the eye closed, the white part of the eye is red, I have excessive tearing. And then if we give them an anesthetic eye drop and their eye pops open and they feel really good, that's going to suggest to us that it is a conjunctival on the pink-white part of your eye or on the cornea, because that pain will go away with the anesthesia. But if I have inflammation in the eye that's low, causing me pain, or I have glaucoma, a topical anesthetic eye drop is not going to solve my problem. And so they're still painful. So we get those clues. Also, as I said, if we add up our data, we're doing a tear test, we're staining the eye, we're measuring the pressures, those clues together helps us hone in on what part of the eye we need to look for.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves. My guest today is Dr. Ralph Hamer. I'm Dana Hill, and we're talking about common eye problems in pets. I should give out the telephone number because a little bit later we may take some phone calls. 352-392-8989. And today is August 13th, so if you're hearing the show today, it is a new show, and you can join the conversation a little bit later when we take some calls. Now, you mentioned something that is it seems like it doesn't even require saying, but because our pets cannot speak to us and explain their vision problems, mm-hmm. they can't do something that humans are able to do, which is get any kind of correction for vision that is otherwise compromised in some way. That is to say that you and I might go to our optometrist. Mm-hmm. The optometrist will use some sophisticated equipment, and we will answer questions like, you know, more blurry, less blurry, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And in the end, we walk out and we have spectacles or contact lenses. Even small children, toddlers, can be examined, mm-hmm. and there can be some correction done to vision. With our pets, there's no practical way to really correct a problem related to something where maybe the lens just isn't focusing properly.
Not on the same level of the average person with a refraction or bending light problem. We're going to deal with that with contacts or glasses, and most people have something like that. So to treat that in a dog, relatively difficult. We can manually refract. So when you're getting refracted, it's that better, worse, better, worse, better, worse game that you play. And they're making you sort of choose the same answer multiple times, which is why they ask you multiple times. Sometimes I get stressed out. It's like, I'm not sure which one's mm-hmm. better. So a dog can't really do that. But so we can do some things to correct a little bit on the cornea, but mainly it's trying to keep the cornea clear. Now, if we're talking lens, the most common lens problem we're going to deal with is they have a cataract, which is an opacity of the lens. We can do cataract surgery in dogs. We have replacement intraocular lenses for dogs and for horses and for cats that are made particularly for them. And we can get their vision just about back to normal for across the room vision. So it kind of depends a little bit on where the problem is, and our most common refractive issue with cataract, and we can fix that.
What would a cataract look like to the pet owner?
Cataract is white, cracked ice, like a piece of paper. Cataract can be small. Cataract can be middle-sized. Cataract can be large. It can stay the same. It can progress. So cataract is white like a piece of paper. We talked before about a normal aging change, which is nuclear sclerosis as the lens gets more dense throughout life. That's, to me, a smoky, blue, gray, cloudy kind of color, but not white like a piece of paper.
Is it on the surface or is it beneath the surface?
It's going to be – that's a great question. The white of a cataract – and when people say where's – it's cloudy. I'm like, where are cloudy? The white of a cataract is behind the iris. So it's behind the color part. It's in the pupil. So your pupil, which should be relatively clear or black, or at night you see the reflective structure, and dogs have a particular part of their retina that reflects that we don't have. If you can't see that, you're blocking that color, the pupil looks white, then that's a cataract. If it's cloudy and you can't see the colored part of the eye, then it's the front of the eye. It's the cornea that's cloudy, or it's in between the cornea and the iris that's cloudy. So we'll have that conversation of, tell me exactly where you think it's cloudy.
A cataract, is it a common problem, and is it particularly in older pets?
A little more common in middle age to older, but young dogs can get it. So the most common cause of cataract in dogs is heritable. They have a genetic problem. The second most common is diabetes. Diabetes mellitus is when they have too much sugar, very common problem in people, very common problem in dogs. And because of how they metabolize sugar in their lens and the and this for particular them, they're very, very prone to cataract after that. And so it's a very, very common thing that we'll do is that they will have cataract and we'll remove that surgically to restore their vision.
If surgery is done to remove cataract, is it ever likely to return?
It shouldn't return. When you do cataract surgery, even if you had a smaller cataract, your lens has a capsule around it. And when you do surgery, you have to go in through the clear part of the eye, the cornea. You make an incision. You tear a small hole in the lens capsule, and you remove the entire lens. So if your cataract is 50%, you remove the cataract and remove the rest of the lens. You have to do that because that material is very antigenic, and if you don't remove it, going to cause severe inflammation. So even if you're a person, the whole lens comes out and then that capsule remains, and that's where most often we will then put a replacement intraocular lens. If you remove all the cataract, it shouldn't come back. The lens capsule will always scar to some level and be a little opaque, but not that really minimizes what we can tell for a clinical visual deficit.
Left untreated, what happens worst case?
With a cataract.
Yeah.
The cataract, again, even if you just leave it, the cataract, again, those proteins in the lens are abnormal when they become a cataract, and they leak through that lens capsule, and they're a source of chronic low-grade inflammation. If you don't treat chronic low-grade inflammation, you're much more likely, up to 60 times more likely, to get secondary glaucoma, which is high pressure. So if your dog has a cataract and you can't afford cataract surgery, which is perfectly fine, then your dog needs to be on a chronic anti-inflammatory eye drop to decrease the incidence of painful glaucoma. So if your dog is blind and comfortable, we can talk about that. We can manage that. They can adapt very well. Blind and painful, we need to fix. So even if you don't do cataract surgery, they need to be on an anti-inflammatory eye drop chronically, because chronic inflammation is really the enemy of the eye.
Surgery is a really fascinating topic when it relates to the eyes, and I want to get to that in the second half of the show. I want to remind listeners right now, you're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, speaking today with Dr. Ralph Heimer, and we're talking about eye problems. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. Of course, my name is Dana Hill, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Ralph Heimer from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about common eye problems, and we may take some calls a little bit later in the show. Our phone number, 352-392-8989. Now, when we left off, Dr. Heimer, we had been discussing cataract and how a cataract surgery could be something that would be beneficial and help correct this problem that may really lead to further problems down the road. And eye surgery, to me, granted, I'm not an expert by any means, but it seems to me as a layman to be one of the more complex kind of surgeries that could possibly be done. The structures of the eye are relatively small, mm-hmm. right, and seem extraordinarily sensitive. I mean, if for instance, a slight a change in the shape of the lens or position of the cornea relative to any other structure of the eye could lead to a change of vision, even if that shift is almost microscopic, then the surgery required would also seem to be that sensitive a procedure, right? Mm-hmm.
They are. It's small. And so a lot of the more sensitive surgeries we're going to do, we're going to have an operating microscope, and we're going to have very small instruments and very small suture that's as small or smaller than the thickness of your hair that we're suturing there. And I hate to say that I'd like to think it's more complex than other things, but, you know, if I can do it, I feel like most people can do it. It's a matter of being trained to do it, and it takes a significant amount of training to do this. All of us that are trained to do this are at least going to do a 3-year residency training program after we've done veterinary school, after we've done an internship, and some programs are even longer than that. So you're going to have to learn how to do microsurgery and get good at it. And again, we have help with the microscope and those kind of things. And some people can do some surgeries that other people are not able to do, depending on what equipment you have, what expertise, and what training you have.
Let's talk about some of the equipment that is used. Obviously, as you say, a lot of it is going to be very small. The microscope is your tool to allow you to see what you're doing under these very small conditions. Mm-hmm. How does one go about making an incision into the eye? You described how you might need to go in there and really get kind of deep into the structure,
sure.
even remove some parts.
Mm-hmm.
That first cut, what is the equipment like?
It's quite small. I mean, you're going to have in the blade that we use to cut into the cornea. Most commonly is a 3-millimeter blade, and we'll make a small beveled sort of stepped incision. So we change the shape of the incision so we can put the cornea back where it's supposed to be. And again, every instrument we use are very, very small. They're like little tiny jeweler's forceps and smaller with itty bitty teeth that you can't really see unless you're underneath the microscope. And again, little tiny needles that are 3 or 4 to 5 millimeters long, depending on what size suture that you're using and where you're wanting to put that instrument or the suture. So they make things that are smaller. We have lasers that we can look and scopes that we can use that are about the size of an 18-gauge needle, which is smaller than the needle you get your blood drawn with, that we can put inside the eye. We can look inside the eye. We can look at structures. We can treat structures with a laser in there, depending what equipment you have. So everything is just miniaturized, and you just sort of learn how to do it.
Now, as someone who's on occasion had trouble just keeping a little bit of food on a fork, I can't imagine the kind of steady hand that would be required to operate miniature medical equipment.
Sure. Don't be a coffee drinker and don't be an adrenaline junkie. I'm not a big coffee drinker anyways. But yeah, you have to have steady hands. And there are things that we do for that too as we're setting up for the surgery. There are particular chairs that have sort of arm bars and arm rests so that you're not trying to hold your hand. If I'm doing cataract surgery for 2 hours, I need to be resting my hands and then my wrists are still and my arms are still, but I'm moving my fingers. And that way I'm not trying to hover my hand over something for, 2 hours. That's just really not possible.
Right.
And you practice and learn that way to go from there. And sometimes I have to take a few deep breaths and go on from there.
Dr. Hamer, let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Ariel in Alachua. Ariel, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for your show.
Yes. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, my question is, when you're talking about the surgeries, I have a dog buddy who is part pug and part wire hair terrier, and so I have concerns. He doesn't have any problems with his eyes at all yet, and I don't think he will, hopefully. But if for some chance that he did, and being part pug, I've heard that because of their noses and with mm-hmm. anesthesia, there can be complications because of the way they're, the whole air passageway.
Sure.
So how would surgery happen for an animal
That's a great question, and we see a lot of those. So again, we call those dogs brachycephalic. So their head shape is squashed in. And my analogy is it's, you know, 10 pounds of dog and 5 pounds of space. So everything sort of crunched together a little bit. And their trachea or their windpipe is smaller, and they tend to have folds in the back of their throat. So what that means, and one of the benefits for me being at the UF Veterinary School, is we have an anesthesia department and we have a surgery department and we have specialists who are trained, and they're going to evaluate that dog. If that dog, maybe your dog needs to have some surgery ahead of time to help improve their airway, or maybe we just need to be careful as we put the tube in. The tube stays in longer. I had a pug a long time ago when I was in my internship, and the dog woke up, and usually they start to wake up and they'll swallow and you pull the tube out. This pug stood up, I mean, for half an hour with the tube in his throat, and I think he's the best he ever breathed in his whole life. But, you know, we can help with that, and there's lots of things we can do to make that as safe as possible. So I wouldn't be terribly concerned about that. If your pug is a big snorer and has a hard time breathing, and, you know, watch out for that, then that's something that we can evaluate for you and work together as a team to make sure we can handle that.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your answer.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Ariel, for calling. I hope, of course, that it never comes to that, and that your dog continues to have good vision. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Dr. Hamer, when you're performing these surgical procedures, as you just mentioned, an anesthesia department, a surgery department, you are in a clinical setting like the one you're in, surrounded by staff who are very good at what they do.
Yes.
And you can work together as a team.
Yes.
To do some of these procedures that might be much more complex without the
mm-hmm.
team.
You're right. Right.
Yeah. And so when you're undergoing when you're giving surgery or performing surgery ahead of time, tell me about some of the things that have happened. Certainly the animal will have undergone an exam to make sure it is a viable candidate for something.
Correct.
Like anesthesia or
mm-hmm.
the surgery in general.
Mm-hmm.
The preparation that you do ahead of time, of course, everybody involved is pretty aware of the condition, what the goals of the surgery are. You're kind of underway. You mentioned that a procedure could take a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
How many people are involved?
Well, a lot from the beginning. And so let's just say the average cataract dog, and if that dog on top of that has diabetes as his cataract, there are a number of hurdles that that dog has to go over before it even has surgery. So we're going to work with your doctor or with the specialist at the veterinary school. We need to make sure the dog is relatively well regulated. That means he's a good candidate for surgery. We need to make sure that his teeth are clean. We need to make sure that his heart is healthy. So we'll do some combinations of at least a physical exam, at least blood work, at least urine cultures and things like that, to make sure that that particular diabetic dog is healthy. If he doesn't have diabetes, we'll do a few smaller hurdles, but they're still there. And there are eye hurdles that we need to get over to make sure the back of the eye is functioning. Then we'll get together with the team and we'll work with anesthesia, depending on the age of the dog and what else may be wrong with them. Do they need blood work? What type of blood work? Do they need, if they have a little bit of a liver problem or a kidney problem, do they need fluids ahead of time, during, after? But they always have it during at a low level, but do they need more? Do they need to have liver function tests? So there's lots of things that we'll work through and make sure. Cataract surgery is a very elective procedure, so we're going to make sure your dog is very healthy and sometimes put up some resistance to doing surgery from our end until we need to make sure your dog is healthy, because a dog can live with cataract, but we want to make sure his kidneys and so owners are, I want the cataract, I want the cataract, I want the cataract. And it's like, you know, we got to get this done first, and then we'll have at least an anesthesia team and at least the ophthalmology team. If the dog has other problems, we may, as we said, involve surgery. If it's a surgical problem that's not about the eye, or we may involve medicine, we may involve neurology, lots of people depending on your dog's particular problem.
Okay, it sounds great that there's a sober approach taken to this, and no surgery is undergone sort of with a cavalier attitude. It's about doing it right and making sure. What about surgeries that may really be essential to alleviate a great deal of discomfort? I mean, mm-hmm. one of the problems you mentioned earlier was glaucoma, mm-hmm. and that can be a painful condition.
Definitely.
Surgery, can that be corrected through surgery?
Some can. Glaucoma is divided into two large categories, primary and secondary. Primary means my drainage apparatus in my eye was made wrong. It's going to eventually fail. Secondary means there's something inside of my eye that has plugged up my drain. Secondary is easier to treat. I can solve the problem, and then my regular drain can hopefully come back and be okay. If it's primary glaucoma, my basic analogy is primary glaucoma is a war. We're going to lose the war, probably. How many battles do you want to fight? How much money do you want to spend? And it depends on the dog, the owner, the situation. We're talking about there are some advanced endolaser procedures to try to treat primary glaucoma. That is a multi-$1,000 procedure. And it's not if your dog has never had cataract surgery, they didn't have their cataract removed in order to visualize what we need to see. And then we have the procedure on top and we monitor. So it's very expensive. And it's a little bit different than my dog was hit by a car, my pelvis is broken, I fix my pelvis, it heals, it's forever. Mm. Laser sounds glamorous, but it's a glamorous way to blow up tissue. And so we got to decide how much we're doing and what's there. So it's a lot of communication with the owner and a lot of discussion about what are your goals, what are the results for your particular dog on this particular day, and where we go from there. And so it's treatable depending when, where, how far are you on the spectrum of when your dog's disease started and when it ends. You say to me, my eye hurts. A dog hides disease. Our animals are genetically imprinted to hide disease. So they hide disease from you. You're not a bad owner. It's just they hide disease. And so it's hard to find it sometimes.
So if something like a glaucoma is discovered and surgery is not really ideal, what means do you have as a veterinarian to at least make the dog's life a bit better?
Yeah, and it depends on what they have. And most often we'll start with anti-glaucoma medicines. There are wonderful ones and far better ones than we had 25 years ago when I was beginning my training. And so there's a lot we can do to extend their visual lifespan with really excellent drugs. And we can continue that. And then we can add in different kinds of surgery at different times, again, depending on the owner and the situation. And we'd really like to do that when we can. Earlier is better. If you're going to do an expensive surgery, the sooner we do it, the sooner we know what's going on, the better the results. If the dog becomes blind and painful, then we need to do some sort of salvage procedure to keep them comfortable. And so blind and comfortable, I'm totally fine with. I owned a blind dog. My blind dog was the happiest dog I've ever owned. I see lots of blind dogs every day. They do great. Blind and painful, we need to treat. Mm-hmm. We need to do something to keep that dog comfortable. And there are multiple surgical procedures. The simplest could be eye removal. And there are some things that are a little bit more cosmetic. We can do some replacements with some things to try to make the eye look a little bit more like an eye. But again, people are sort of very attached to their dog's eyes. They sort of like their expression. They like what they look like. And that's normal. And so sometimes we have to kind of work hard together as a team to say, hey, you know, your dog is painful. And whenever I have a dog that's painful and they just do fine because dogs are tough and we have to take the eye out, the owner always, always, always comes back and says, my dog feels better. I'm really glad I did that. And that's an important thing, that dogs are tough. They just play the cards they're dealt. They don't fuss about it. They just deal with it.
In some of these conditions, say glaucoma or cataract, is it more or less likely that the problem will be in both eyes?
If it's primary glaucoma, it's going to happen in both eyes because it's the drains were made wrong and both are going to be made wrong. One starts first. I don't know why. It just does. Cataract, generally both eyes. If it's diabetic cataract, it's a systemic disease, so you're going to get it in both eyes. If it's heritable cataract, sometimes one, not the other. Sometimes one worse than the other. One needs surgery, one may not. So again, it's everything is not a recipe in a cookbook. Every dog's an individual dog, and we need to handle it a little bit individually. But it depends on the situation of that particular dog, that particular breed. We can help talk about odds based on your dog, your situation.
Mm. And should something like eye removal be required, or at least be a serviceable option? If we know that animals can, our pets can sort of do well enough without vision at all, presumably they can do pretty well with just one eye. I mean, mm-hmm. binocular vision is probably not essential to the survival.
Not essential. No, they do great. I own a one-eyed dog. Lots of ophthalmologists seem to. And she does great. You know, sometimes when she's very interested in a squirrel, she falls off the sidewalk because she's looking at the squirrel. But aside from that, you'd never know. And as I mentioned before, I owned a blind dog. If you were in my home with my blind dog, you'd never know she was blind. I lived in a two-story house. I could be anywhere in my house and tell her to go to her kennel, and she'd go to her kennel. I could. They have a map. I swear dogs can count stairs, count doors. They know where they are. They know what they're doing, and they're fine. And they just do well. They just figure it out, and they just do it. So when people say, hey, my dog is blind, do I have to consider putting them to sleep? And I always say, you know, give me 2 months. Your dog will be fine. And they just do so well.
Right, that's great to hear. Let's go back to the phones. Bill in Hernando. Bill, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi, I just wondered, is your local vet going to be able to do the surgery for, you know, the cataracts?
No, sir. That takes, I would say anytime you're going to do a cataract surgery, I would say that takes specialized training with specialized equipment. In today's world, I don't think there's probably a referring or general veterinarian that would even offer that service to you.
We'd have to go up to the universities.
You can, or there are actually, while there are about 28, 29 veterinary schools in the country, and UF is obviously the one in Florida, Right. But depending on where you live, there are actually more veterinary ophthalmologists in private practice than there are at veterinary schools by far. So in your area, you may very well have a specialty clinic or a referral clinic that has referral surgeons and internal medicine, and they'll have ophthalmologists there too. And so we're quite easy to find. Currently, there are about 450 veterinary ophthalmologists in the world, and most of them are in the United States. So, you know, you can find one. Florida has a lot of them.
Now, I think you were saying like $1,000 or more, you know,
For cataract surgery? Cataract surgery is probably going to be a $4,000-y cost start to finish for both eyes or more, depending on where you are and who's doing the surgery. So, and that's sort of my dog walks in the front door, has exam, has testing, has the surgery, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's going to be at least a $4,000, and I've seen as much as five or more depending on the location.
Well, you pretty want to make sure the dog's young.
Well, you know, it depends on the owner, and I would say to that too. The oldest I've done is a 17-and-a-half-year-old poodle, and I don't know that I would have done it, but the dog lived for another year and a half, and the owner was delighted.
Bill, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's all up to the owner.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, listen, thank you so much for the phone call. I really appreciate it. We have a little bit of time left, Dr. Hamer. I want to talk about another sort of part of the eye and where this is kind of an important part of the eye, because this is where the eye kind of meets the most important part of our whole body, the brain, the optic nerve.
Yes.
What kind of problems can happen with the optic nerve?
The most common that we will see is inflammation or infection, and that can happen from immune-mediated diseases. It can happen from infectious diseases, and so that is typically where the optic nerve becomes inflamed. It can also become swollen from pressure. So if you have a mass or a growth in your brain or somewhere along the tract where the optic nerve goes, there can be pressure up against it. You can actually have a tumor in the optic nerve. So an optic nerve is challenging because our ability to visualize it and see where things are, and this is where advanced imaging becomes quite important. So we have a very nice MRI, and we can put your dog in the MRI, and we can really visualize his optic nerve and where is it and is it swollen. And is it inflamed? And then even, you know, get a biopsy or tissues or spinal fluid samples if we need to. So they're all things that we can do to try to assess it. But it's a lot harder compared to my dog has a corneal ulcer. The optic nerve is much more challenging to diagnose and treat. It's also very sensitive tissue. Nerves, when they're damaged, don't like to get better. So often the damage that's there can be permanent. And so we try to reverse it when we can. But we may not be able to reverse. We might just try to keep what we have.
Is it uncommon for eye problems themselves to be, kind of mortal injuries or diseases?
more eye problems are just eye problems, but eye problems can be a manifestation of a systemic disease problem. So, you know, I like to say the eye is kind of the window to the soul. We can look in an eye, we can actually see a blood vessel, we can actually see a nerve, and it's the only organ where you can do that. And so the eye can give us some clues as to, do I have a systemic disease? Do I have a systemic infection or systemic inflammation? Do I have a systemic tumor that can show up in the eye that can manifest? Sometimes we have to try to figure out, is this dog's eye problem just an eye problem, or is this a whole body problem that is manifesting itself in the eye? And so that's where we'll work together as a team approach to try to figure that out.
Then this kind of ties this up all into a nice bow, because I would generally close the program by asking what would be your best advice to someone who is concerned about the eyes of his or her pet. And it sounds like what you're probably going to say is the veterinary exam, a regular veterinary exam.
Sure. Definitely. And as your eye ages, then a more complete ophthalmic exam should be part of that. And so they may want to measure pressures rather than just looking with a light. They may want to look in the back rather than they might not normally do that. So for sure, it's all about exam. And people will call and, what do I do? And I said, you know, sometimes it's really hard for me to give advice until we get some more data. And we need to get that from an exam with your veterinarian. They can do a lot to help us and or come see us. And we're happy to try to navigate that and figure it out.
Very briefly, I gather we've already made great strides in the treatment of some of these problems. In about a minute, do you feel that there's more good stuff on the horizon?
Oh, gosh, yes. The world of veterinary ophthalmology has changed so dramatically in the past 25 years for me. And what we are able to do every day and what we're able to fix every day. And we're so much better with disease. We have better tools that we can manipulate for the eye and manage them. So there's so many, many things. And we kind of follow along the cusp of what's happening in people and sometimes lead the way. There's research on dog eyes that help genetic retinal disease that's helping people. And so we can work those things together. So, oh, yes, every year you do this, and certainly every 5 years I do this, more amazing things that we can do.
Well, Dr. Ralph Hamer from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. A fascinating topic, and I'm so glad that you joined the program.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'll come back anytime.
I want to say thank you to Richard Drake in the control room for directing the show. I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey and her staff at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. Hope you'll join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.